It's not polite to talk about brown and black people dying because rich white people in America feel better about themselves when the brown and black people don't get to use DDT.
I'm Catherine Mengue Ward for Reason TV, and I'm here today with Andrew Morris, co-editor of a new volume, Silent Spring at 50. Andrew, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Tell me a little bit about Rachel Carson, who wrote the environmentalist classic Silent Spring 50 years ago, and why you felt like it was time to take her on now.
Well, let me start with why we thought we should take her on now. It's the 50th anniversary of the book that many people think founded modern American environmentalism, that shifted the emphasis from conservation to a more radical view of man outside of nature, and that's a view that continues to dominate the American environmental movement. We knew there would be a lot of laudatory things said about this, and so we wanted to give a more critical assessment of it.
What do you think is one area where Rachel Carson, who obviously is responsible for the limiting of the use of DDT radically in both in the United States and eventually internationally, what are some of the costs that her work has imposed that people tend to overlook?
Well, the most important cost comes from the limit on the use of DDT in malaria control. Carson spent 250 pages talking about the dangers of chemical use, specifically DDT use, and created this marvelous image of a silent spring where no birds sang and scared the hell out of people. The result of that is millions and millions of poor people in Africa and Asia and Latin America died of malaria. And that's an enormous cost that environmentalists don't ever want to talk about.
In her discussion of DDT, did she have a point about the ways that it was being used or misused, or did she just screw the pooch on this one entirely?
She was absolutely right about one thing, and that's that there were massive subsidized spraying programs going on in which the U.S. Department of Agriculture was blanketing the country with not just DDT but other insecticides in some very ill-considered spraying programs to control agricultural pests. And those programs paid no attention to people's property rights. And out of that came some well-justified lawsuits against the USDA, which failed, in which the courts ruled that private property rights have to get out of the way when the public interest is at stake. And surely, if the USDA is doing it, then the public interest is at stake. And so she was right about that. We shouldn't have been subsidizing massive spraying of people's property against their will. But that's about the only thing she was right about.
What charges can we ultimately lay at Rachel Carson's door? I mean, I know that doing a sort of strict death toll might be an exaggeration, but can you just kind of give a quick point by point of, you know, what are the changes that we can trace pretty directly to Silent Spring, and sort of what are the hopes for reversing those or otherwise limiting the damage now?
Well, I think the three things that we should worry about, and we have chapters that address all these, are is one is really is the death toll. People don't want to talk about it because it's not polite to talk about brown and black people dying because rich white people in America feel better about themselves when the brown and black people don't get to use DDT. But that's the fact of it. We have denied other countries the ability to use the single most effective tool to stop malaria. And so those millions and millions of deaths, I think, can be clearly laid at the door of Silent Spring. The second is that Carson really was an advocate for nationalization of environmental policy. And I think we can trace the environmental movement that grew out of Silent Spring really had an impact on moving environmental policy out of the state level to the federal level. And that's really been a cost. We lost a lot of flexibility and a lot of ability to adapt to local conditions in that. And the third thing is that she was a big pusher for this balance of nature idea. And that's not how conservation biologists think about things today. We have an excellent chapter in the book by a conservation biologist who points out that the whole balance of nature, the circle of life, this is not the way that biologists think about things. But that idea is firmly embedded in the public psyche, in part because of Rachel Carson.
Who are the heirs of Rachel Carson?
Well, the heirs of Rachel Carson are the national environmental organizations that want to control our lives. Carson advocated a variety of precautionary measures. Nothing should be used without extensive testing. She's in some sense the godmother of the precautionary principle. I don't think there is a Rachel Carson of today, and that none of the modern environmental writers write nearly as well as Rachel Carson, and none of them have the skill and ability that she had or the moral authority that she had. They wish they were Rachel Carson. The interesting question would be, what would have happened if Rachel Carson had not died of cancer? She's not quite as radical as some of her followers are. And it's her timely death, in that sense, save them from her ever having to reconsider some of the ideas that she put forward in the book. And since she was a scientist, I like to think that maybe when better information came along, she would have paid attention to it.
Thank you very much for speaking with Reason TV. This is Andrew Morris, co-editor of Silent Spring at 50. For Reason TV, I'm Catherine Mangue Ward.